Welcome to Babbittville Radio. My name is Bob Babbitt. We're brought to you by RacePlace.com, Ceramic Speed, RunCatalina.com. You can check out any of our interviews on Babbittville and the Challenged Athletes Foundation. We've raised over $64 million to keep people in the game of life through sport. Our next guest is the Ironman 70.3 Boulder champion, Cal Millward. Cal, how are you?
Yeah, really good. Thanks, Bob. Thanks for having me.
No problem. Hey, it's always nice to win something in your hometown.
Yeah, no, it kind of seems like everyone, it's just all the local crew here. And, I mean, the local crew in Boulder is pretty much as good as anywhere in the world. So it's like a mini world champs.
So, Cal, take me back a little bit. Growing up in New Zealand, rugby, cricket, all the usuals?
Yeah, pretty much. I played rugby and cricket right through until I was about 13, and then I stopped growing, and all the local Polynesian and Maori boys keep growing, and I decided it was probably time to make a call, and I sort of carried on with, I'd always run and always swim, so I just thought that was more my calling, and I mean, I still love rugby, I still follow it. My parents are pretty passionate All Black supporters, which is our national team,
yeah.
And for our little country, we punch pretty well above our weight when it comes to rugby. So, yeah, I mean, I guess it's the equivalent of basketball or NFL in this country.
Well, and you think about New Zealand, besides, obviously, your triathletes with Rick Wells and Cam Brown, but going back to John Walker and Rod Dixon and Peter Snell, I mean, you guys have a great sport, endurance sports heritage.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, one of my first coach actually was Peter Fitzinger, who is an American and
won the Olympic trials in 1984.
Yep, exactly. And I think that was up around Niagara Falls somewhere, right?
Yes, it was in Buffalo, New York, yeah.
Yeah, so, I mean, he kind of, and he married a New Zealand runner, Chrissy Fitzinger. I've forgotten her maiden name.
Yeah.
And she was, I think, coached by Arch Jelly, and that sort of flows on from, you know, the Lydia Deer and all those, Peter Snell and John Walker and that. And, I mean, even I lived in Auckland for 6 years, and a lot of the routes they ran in the Waitakere Range is, you know, that's familiar, and it's just, it's cool sort of heritage. Like, the long Sunday morning run was this big loop in the Waitakere Ranges, which is super hilly, and
yeah.
I think it's just really cool.
So when were you more into, you know, the running side or the swimming side or both?
Probably more running. I wasn't a great swimmer. I was okay, but I was never a national level swimmer. And running, I was okay. My best result was probably a fourth at New Zealand National Secondary Schools. But, I mean,
yeah,
you think you're training all right, but then I grew up in a little town on the East Coast, just in about an hour southeast of Taupo where the Ironman is.
Yeah.
And we would turn up to the national secondary schools, and you'd be going against the boys from Auckland and Wellington, and
right,
just so much deeper, the field. So, and then again, the next level up from that is older brother in Australia are just, you know, it's even deeper over there, and they're super strong as well. So, I mean, it's not a bad part of the world to come from.
No. In terms of the sport of triathlon, how aware were you of that in high school during that era?
I mean, I was sort of nowhere at high school. I did a couple of New Zealand secondary school races, and I don't even think I got in the top 10 in any of the years that I competed. So I was sort of nobody, and then I went through college, or university in New Zealand, as we call it, and then once I finished that, I decided to throw my hat in the ring, and I moved to the Gold Coast in Australia to train with Cole Stewart for a couple of years.
Wow. So you're training with Cole, who is the coach of Miles Stewart, who was an Australian Olympian. And Cole's one of the best in the business. So at that point, were you thinking Olympics, the Olympic style and Olympic format?
Yeah, exactly. So, I mean, that was a fast road to sort of learning, throw your hat straight in the ring. And
yeah,
Miles was sort of winding out by then. But there was still a good group of athletes there. I remember Leon Griffin came along for a little while,
yep.
And there were plenty of good athletes there. So, yeah, that was the plan. And then I did well at the Australia-New Zealand Under-23 Championships and got selected for the New Zealand team for the ITU Worlds in Lausanne in 2006. So
that's pretty exciting stuff.
Once I made that team, then you get into the New Zealand national program, and that's when to make the most of the resources and the support from the National Federation was my best interest to move back to Auckland. And that's when I was looking for a coach, and Pete Fitzinger took me on, and he was also coaching Debbie Tanner at the time, who was just starting to take names as well and do really well for herself.
So with your, not having that swim background, I'm guessing that was a limitation when it came to that Olympic format, because that's, if you're not with those guys out of the water, you're pretty much chasing all day long.
Yeah, I mean, I could swim okay, but, 15 or 20 seconds in an ITU race, it's dead. Game over.
Yeah, because you have to work so hard on the bike just to get in the same zip code as those guys, and then they're running 29 minutes off the bike.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, it felt a little bit slower then. I mean, the benchmark was sort of Brad Carterfeld or Bevan Doherty. But still, like, you had to be running low 30s, and it was just, I was really hit and miss with my swimming, if I'd make the front group or the chase group, and yeah, it's so cutthroat. I remember just, you're diving in off the pontoon, and it's balls to the wall, so to speak. It's just flat out, and it literally is just flat out. And then I know a lot of people tend to speculate that the bike is pretty much a coast, but it's so intense. I remember doing Hamburg World Cup 1 year, and I was just, it just tears your legs off. You're just spiking. It's a lot different to long course.
Well, the difference is that it's like racing a criterium, because you're going so hard. Someone makes a move, you got to go with. You got to mark everybody the whole time. And once the Brownlees got in and Gomez got in, that any thought of you can swim and sort of hang around on the bike and then run fast was gone, because those guys were off the front right from. I remember Macca telling me when he went back to short course trying to make the London games, and he was like, mate, I had no idea. He came off the bike ran a 31:30 and was in 50th place. And you're going, it's a different game, just a different world.
Yeah, there's no room for error at all. And I don't know how those boys do it week in, week out, especially the Brownlees and Gomez. And, I mean, there's a few other guys putting their hands up, like Richard Murray some of Joel Filioli's boys. But, it's so cutthroat.
It's brutal.
Maximum respect for them.
So when did you dip your toe in the water in terms of the longer distance, which obviously suits you better?
I think in about 2010 or 11, I remember my final race in Europe was to the Tavares World Cup, and I just decided after that it's probably time to move up. And I mean, with the National Federation as well, they'll squeeze you out if you're not performing, and so you get a few privileges revoked, and it's more or less they show you the red card and it's time to move on. So I mean, you can keep trying to race Olympic distance ITU and throw your hat in the ring, but it's quite difficult without that funding.
Well, because you got to get to the races.
Yeah, exactly. And even the funding that they did give you then was pretty limited. So I think it was around 2010, 2011 that I decided to have a go. And, I mean, I was quite looking forward to coming to the U.S. and racing here. I'd spent a couple of small stints in Boulder, Colorado, on our build-ups before Hy-Vee, when that was like an ITU race.
Right. So when you came over, what was your first 70.3?
I think it was actually that race in Boise, Idaho, where
that Matty Reid race.
I had a sprint finish with Matty Reid, and we.
Now, was that the one where the swim was canceled and you guys were in wetsuits during the bike and that type of stuff?
Yeah. So the swim still remained the same.
Yeah.
And they just reduced the bike course, and I just remember sitting at the reservoir waiting for the race to start, and it was just so cold, and I just thought, well, it was my first pro race in the US, and I just thought, I've still got to give out the prize money, so someone's got to take it. So I just, I was young and naive as well, and it was kind of probably a blessing that I didn't know who a lot of the athletes were. I mean, there was Tim O'Donnell, there's Matty Reid, I think Paul Matthews, and a bunch of others. And I had a great swim, and I'd actually just been training with Craig Walton for a couple of months in Australia before I left. So I had a fair bit of leg speed and good swimming, but my biking wasn't that great. But I think the reduced bike course played into my hands there.
I remember Matty told me he wore his wetsuit during the bike ride because the bike was so short.
Yeah, I think the bike ride was reduced. I can't even remember how long it was. Maybe it was about 20 or 30 k. But
yeah,
we more or less they chopped about 2/3 of the bike out, and I just thought I'm getting rid of everything. I covered my whole body in Vaseline, I remember, just to try and give myself a little bit of insulation. I would have looked a little creepy, but it worked. And I just remember the first mile is a descent from the dam back down to sort of regular level, I guess, elevation.
Yeah.
And it was just bitterly cold. And I remember riding behind Tim O'Donnell, and I was in second place, and I thought, this is going pretty well. And then I looked up. He was about 200 meters up the road, and he just rode straight into a witch's hat and just...
Oh, you went right into a cone?
He did.
Oh, he went right into a cone because he was so cold, he probably didn't see it.
Yeah, he said he just locked up and couldn't turn, and we're on like a straight piece of road. And it was kind of funny, but it was kind of just heartache for him at the same time. And he jumped back on his bike at the same... He jumped back on his bike just as I overtook him. But the only issue was that his seat, I think, was not misaligned now.
Yeah. Well, and the hard part is when you're that cold and you get hypothermic like that, you just can't control anything.
It's horrible. So I figured I won an ITU points race in Austin when it was like 40 degrees Celsius, and then I had a great race at Boise there where I think it was like single figures Celsius as well. So it's the best of both worlds. I mean, it gives you a little bit of confidence. I can perform in a couple of different conditions.
You like the bad conditions.
Yeah,
even if you don't like them, even though you like them, you perform in them.
Yeah, I've yet to master hail or hurricane conditions, but I mean, I don't want to jinx myself.
So is the goal down the line to get to Kona and do the iron distance, or are you happy with 70.3?
No, for sure. So this will be my first year where I'll try and qualify for Kona. I'm sitting 44th on the ranking. Melbourne in March, Melbourne Ironman was my debut race there, and I went 8:14, I think.
Yay, first time out, look at that.
Yeah, so, I mean, it was an all right race, but I just fell apart halfway through the run, and I remember talking to Jeff Simons the day before when we were giving out medals at a kids' race, and he just said everyone falls apart the final 10K anyway, so...
He's right.
Yeah, it is what it is, and he went on to have a great race.
So you're sitting 44th right now. Do you have to do another full?
I think so. So, I mean, I picked up a bunch of points at Boulder last weekend and racing Ironman Coeur d'Alene this coming weekend. So, as long as I top five in Coeur d'Alene, I should get across the line. Yeah,
awesome. That's the hard part about that whole qualification thing. Now, that means you've got, for someone who is a sort of a rookie Ironman, you've done two fulls in one summer with the biggest race still to come. And, you know, so it means you're a little more fatigued than some of the other guys.
Yeah, I mean, I trained quite a lot with Tim Burkle, who came in seventh last year, and he's having a great race. He's actually in fourth and still about 5Ks to go, and the wheels fell off. But, unless, I think Brad Cutterfelt's one of the only other guys who's going to get away with just doing the one Ironman in his first year, where he got third in Melbourne.
Yeah.
So that was the only other option, was to really nail the first Ironman and debut. But I could roll the dice and not race another Ironman and just bank on trying to do another good 70.3, but I don't want to be sitting on the fence.
Well, the last thing you wanted is to get into late July, August, and realize, I got to do another one now. At least you're getting this out of the way in June.
Yeah, exactly. So hopefully after that, I'll just have to do my best for recovery and rest up. And, I mean, the only other way to look at it, really, is that I've not done a bunch of Ironman in my legs that are reasonably fresh.
Now, what did you learn from Melbourne that's going to help you in Coeur d'Alene?
That the run's really hard.
You think?
Yeah, I just remember starting the run, and we came off the bike, a huge group of us, maybe 8 or 10, and I remember Marco Albert took off, and I was just trying to stick to a pace of around 3:50 k's, so run a mid-240 Ironman run, and I just remember holding back, and I ran past a friend of mine, Liz Blatchford, and she said, you know, good luck, you're going well, you're looking good. And I was like, this is easy.
And then famous last words.
Yeah, exactly. And then 5Ks later, around the 7 or 8K mark, I guess, Jeffrey Simons ran up to me and he said, have you ever had a Canadian on Cupcakes with Cal? And I just thought, what's even going on right now? Do I even engage him and talk to him? Or do I put on the poker face? Or
so he tried to talk to you like when he caught you.
Oh yeah, he did. Like he ran up next to me, and I mean,
that's a Macca move.
Yeah, I wouldn't. I mean, his sort of his thing is running ugly and getting ugly on the run, and I guess he stays true to his word. Like he's not the most efficient looking runner, but he gets the job done, and he sort of he's just a cool, passionate guy.
Yeah.
I quite like him, and so I was like, nah, I haven't actually, Jeff. I was like, you could be the first if you want. And we had a little conversation for a few minutes, and then he took off, and I just thought, I can't really let him go. So I just carried on after him, and I overtook him again. I thought that would be the last I saw of him. But turns out a few kilometers later, he came back, and then he took off like a man possessed and just ran straight up. Brad Carterfelt was sitting a few hundred meters in front of us, and then he started to try to talk to Brad, and... Brad gave him the silent treatment, and I don't know if that irritated him, but then Jeffrey he carried on running right through the field and went on to win.
That's cool. That is really cool. So winning this last, was this your second Ironman 70.3 win?
Yes. Yes.
That's cool.
It's been a little while between drinks.
And so, I mean, you ran like 1:16 off the bike. You had a great day. In terms of, you know the course, obviously. You've been there, you've raced there a few different times. What made this one, what made it different? It's hard to win, right? It's finishing top five is great, but it's hard to win a race. What separated this one for you? Where did you make the move that allowed you to win this thing?
Well, I think it was the combination of a few events. It's more or less the same field that lines up here each year. This year, with the exception of Joe Gambles, who's living in Europe. And I just thought, obviously, it's Tim Don's race to lose. He's the top-ranked of the boys here. And then you've got Ben Hoffman, who I figured might be a little tired after Ironman Texas. Richie Cunningham, who's always, you know, you can't rule him out. And then...
Was Greg Bennett there?
Greg Bennett was there, and then...
Ambrose. Yeah, you had a good field.
Yeah, so it was a good field, and the only difference this year was the run course was out and back twice on what I thought was a flatter, maybe faster course.
Mm.
I mean, it's still a trail and off-road, but the thing that really shook up the race was, I think, when Mark Boasted came through on the bike after about 20, 25 kilometres, and... He's never content to sit in. I've always raced the Boasted brothers in New Zealand. So I know their style, and it's all or nothing. And, you know, they'll live by the sword and die by the sword, or
yeah.
Watts, if you want to look at it that way. And so they caught us, or he caught us, and then he just started to drive it. And prior to Mark catching us, Greg Bennett had a crack, because I had a feeling he was going to have a crack on the bike as well. And there was a group of six of us on the bike, and... I just thought, I don't want to come off the bike with Tim Don and get into a running race here. It's,
he ran one like 1:11 last year or something.
Yeah, he did. And to be fair, I thought the run course would have been a little bit quicker this year, but I think the fact that we biked so hard, it kind of put a bit of sting into a lot of the boys' legs.
Yeah.
So Mark ended up sort of blowing the bike apart, and I went with him. Tim Don was... right up the front of sort of this pace line, and he sat up as Mark came through, and I just thought, I think this is maybe the move to be in. And and then we sort of just hovered off the front of this long line for quite a while, and then eventually the bungee cord snapped and we got away.
Well, and then he got what? He had about a little under 2 minutes off the bike?
Yeah, so Mark had, I think, a minute 50 on me, and then I was solo, and then there was maybe another minute 10 back to Tim Don's group. So
that's always tough when you got a guy who ran 1:11 and one of the best pure runners in the sport, and he's only a minute back.
Yeah, it's a little bit like bringing a knife to a gunfight.
Exactly.
I got a split from Julie Dibbins after about a mile to say that her boy Tim Don was a minute 10 behind, and I just thought, oh, you know, like my goose is cooked here. It's going to catch me maybe by the 5 kilometer turnaround mark. And yeah, he didn't. I kept just trying to reel in Mark, and I eventually pulled him back just after halfway, and then the gap to Tim
stayed the same. He took like 5 seconds off you, like 16:25 to 16:30. He took you basically held it.
Yeah, exactly. So I don't know. I was super happy with it. I mean, it wasn't a priority race for me. The priority race right now is to do well in Coeur d'Alene. I sat down with my coach, Matt Steinmetz, and across these two races, Boulder and Ironman Coeur d'Alene, the goal was just to be sensible and get a bunch of points at each race. And, I mean, a good result at both of these races is the top three, top four, top five even. And, you know, you don't want to go from hero to zero and try and win the race and then finish 10th and walk away with nothing.
But the nice thing is to you get some bragging rights when you win in your hometown.
Yeah, but that doesn't work real good. Coming from New Zealand, we get put back in place pretty quickly. I remember I FaceTimed Mum and Dad when they woke up, and they quickly remind me that I'm still just their son, and that they didn't even seem that excited for me. And I asked if they watched the race, and they did. And but yeah, I think that's good and bad. They're just happy no matter what. So
sure, yeah, they don't. Yeah. So talk a little bit about cupcakes with Cal. What's interesting in this day and age, a pro is winning a race is great, but you have to do a lot more than that. You have to be, you know, to a certain degree, you're a travel agent, you're a PR guy, you're a representative and ambassador for all your sponsors. When you started Cupcakes with Cal, was the purpose of that just to, you know, show your personality a little bit and give some insight into what makes the pros tick?
Excuse me. I guess it kind of just fell into that. I think last year was the first year of Cupcakes with Cal.
Yeah.
And in 2013, I actually did my first video where, which was kind of inspired, not really by revenge or anything, but just, I don't know, I have quite a sarcastic personality. And I remember seeing the National New Zealand team, which is based in Spain, a couple of the boys like Ryan Sissons and Tony Dodds, they did a video where it was kind of like an MTV Cribs theme video. And they're in this nice big, almost mansion-like place in Spain, and they're just holding their iPhone videoing it, and it almost seemed like I was sort of showing off these luxurious conditions. And I just thought, well, there's a bunch of us boys here in Boulder, Colorado, and why don't we just tell it how it is for the people who aren't funded by the national program and how we're doing it off our own back. And that video got picked up by Slow Twitch, I think, and it got received pretty well. And
yeah,
it was just fun. And Liz Blatchford's husband, Glenn Murray, who runs Corrupt Vision, he came along and filmed it. And a lot of the boys here who I knock around with, the Australians and New Zealanders, we all have a similar sense of humor.
Exactly.
And,
yeah,
we just thought, let's have some fun with this.
Yeah.
So I don't really know how Cupcakes with Cal came along last year. I think we just thought, hey, let's maybe do another video. And, like, I don't have any journalism experience, and I learned how to edit a lot of the videos myself, just watching YouTube videos, and I bought Final Cut Pro and a few other things, and I guess the rest is sort of history.
Good for you, man. That's great. It's really it's really a fun era because, you know, you can bring people behind the scenes and show the, you know, your average age grouper what goes on, you know, how hard it is. People don't realize, I think people think that as a professional triathlete, you're like a professional rugby guy or professional football guy, that people are catering to you and all you have to do is, you know, all you have to do is go to workouts. They don't realize that you have to do everything. You got to go grocery shopping, you have a regular life, and oh, by the way, you got to go race some of the best guys in the world on the weekend.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, it's the salary might be limited, but I mean, this conversation comes up a lot. How you know, I guess the general consensus is pros feel undervalued, but at the end of the day, I think we still get to live a pretty cool life, and you know,
yeah,
we can meet up for a coffee in the afternoon, and we don't earn great money. Some people do, but it's still a cool thing. And I don't know. I don't think I'd. Or maybe I would trade it in for being a rugby player or a musician or something like that. But I'm pretty happy with the way things have turned out.
Well, the nice thing is you know, this is something you can do for as long as you want to do it. And if you want to go back and, you know, get a quote-unquote real job sometime, you know, you have that possibility. But at this point, you're seeing the world, and you're enjoying yourself, and you're with, you know, are there better people than the pros and the age groupers out there? People love what they do.
Yeah, and I feel like it's still a pretty, it's a pretty close-knit community, and I've made some pretty cool friends, so I don't know. I enjoy it. I definitely wouldn't trade it for too many other jobs in the world. I have friends back in Australia where I live now, and they have the 9-to-5 job, and they have a house and a mortgage, the dog, a station wagon, and I think, oh, it'd be great to have that security, but at the same time, they're living for the Saturday and Sunday, and I just think it's cool that what we can do.
Well, it's funny. I remember one of the early interviews with Macca, him telling me how he, you know, he had a job. All he wanted to do was have an accounting job because his parents stressed education. They got the accounting job looking over Sydney Harbor and hated every minute of it. It's like, yeah. You go through college to get that great job and realize that, you know what, I want to go run, bike, and swim and see if I can make a living doing it.
Yeah, exactly. I actually remember that interview, and he's got some great stories, hasn't he?
Oh, the best. Just the best. Hey, Cal, congrats on everything you're doing. That's a huge win. Obviously, you're doing the right stuff when you're in the midst of Ironman training and you win a 70.3. That means your speed is there, your strength is there, and Coeur d'Alene, I think, is going to go really well for you.
Yeah, thanks, Bob. I'm a little bit nervous for the weekend because obviously I'm racing Andy Potts and Mike Kvalsik and Leon Griffin, and everyone's sort of got the same idea of, you know, we're all chasing our tail trying to get points to get across the line for Kona, and been training with Griff here a little bit, and he's in the same boat where he's like, we need to finish well this weekend and get to Kona, and I mean, it's just that opportunity. If you can do well at Kona, it sets you up pretty well.
It changes everything. Right?
Yep.
It changes everything at one day, year and end. It's funny because before you were chasing the Olympics, and Olympics is one day every 4 years. With us, it's that one day every year. So it's the most important day, and the main thing is to get to that starting line.
Yeah, I got out there last year, actually. Quintana Roo flew me out there to do my cupcake videos. And
yeah.
So I filmed a bunch of the guys out there, and the plan with the interviews as well is always to go for the heavy hitters as well, especially when you're just trying to start out, just to use their reach as well.
Right.
And I think it gives you a little bit of credibility.
No question.
So it was really cool to, you know, drop into Jan Frodeno's house or Crowley's house or Meredith Kessler's house. And I mean, I'm only there for an hour or so, but sort of see how, you know, their mindset or how they're set up. And then on race day as well, I managed to get out in the car and onto the Queen K and watch the race or a part of it, and it's just unreal. It's just it's not like I would ever imagine. Just it seemed like the circus rolls into town for 2 weeks, and it's just I can't wait to get back there as a competitor.
Well, and you know what, when you get a chance to watch it like you did, you learn so much. It really helps when you come back to race it for the first time.
I think so. I mean, I was sort of cheering for my I wouldn't say fellow Aussies, but my adopted Aussies, Tim Burkle and Tim Reed, and I remember just pulling up next to them in the car and giving them a cheer, and they're in the pace line, which seemed like 20 deep, and they just seemed relaxed, and it just seemed like a long day, like settle in. The screws will eventually tighten, and I'm happy for Tim. Tim Burkle, he had a great race, and even just from his experience, like living vicariously through him, his sponsorships have all increased. And I know it's just an exciting prospect to go over there and do well, but I mean, I'm under no illusions how hard it is as well.
Hey, well, Cal, good luck next weekend at Coeur d'Alene. I'm sure you'll have a great one. Thanks so much for taking time, and congrats on everything you're doing with Cupcakes with Cal. It's a lot of fun.
Thanks very much, Bob.
All right. Cal Millward has been our guest. Again, we're brought to you by RacePlace.com, Ceramic Speed, RonCatalina.com. Check out all of our interviews on Babbittville, and don't forget to support the Challenged Athletes Foundation. Hold on, everybody. We will be right back.